This is LIS Radio, a production of the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri Columbia.
Welcome to the LIS First Tuesday webcast. I'm Linda Esser, your host for this evening. The First Tuesday is a project of the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri Columbia. Our special guest this evening is Dr. Mary Kate Chelton of Queens College, City University of New York. Dr. Mary Kate Chelton has worked in both public and academic libraries, including Rockville, Maryland, and Westchester Library System in Hartsdale, New York. She holds master's degrees in library science from Rutgers University and also in public health education from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and her PhD is from Rutgers in communication. She's been an honoree for the ALA Intellectual Freedom Award, received the Association for Library and Information Science Educators Outstanding Dissertation Award, the Grolier Foundation Award, and the Rutgers Distinguished Alumna Award, and she was named the first Librarian of the Year award winner by the Romance Writers of America. Her writings have been published in VOYA, Library Journal, the Journal of Education for Library and Information Science, among others. Her opinion piece, recently published in American Libraries in the August 2005 issue, is a frank discussion of the prospects of youth services faculty in LIS programs. She's the co-founder of VOYA, along with Dorothy M. Broderick, and that's provided a space for youth services librarians to share the best of programming, facilities, ideas, and experiences, and also provided reviews since 1978. She testified on behalf of ALA at the SIPA court hearings in 2003, and currently she's a professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Studies, Queens College, City University of New York. Her faculty resume describes her primary research interests as marginalized or stigmatized user, young adults, materials and services in library contexts, in particular the information-seeking behavior of adolescents and adoption searchers, adult-adolescent service encounters, library services for young adults, readers advisory services for adults, and popular culture genres in library, especially romance fiction. Her teaching responsibilities include literature for young adults, resources for school curriculum, reading motivation for children and young adults, planning and delivering services to young adults in the public library, and reader advisory services for adults in the public library. We are absolutely delighted to welcome Dr. Chelton as this evening's special guest. Mary Kay, did you get home okay?
Yes, I did.
Good.
In fact, I got home early just after I got all worried about whether I would even make it in time for this. But my students were taking a midterm in the basic reference course, and I said, I'm leaving at 6:20. You're on your honor. Just stick it in my mailbox. I'm going. And I just So all the nervous Nellies didn't have a chance to come and ask me questions to make me and them crazy. So,
did you have time to pet your dogs?
Oh, yeah. I even had time to eat some soup, so I'm in quite a nice, mellow mood.
Okay. Let me give the telephone numbers for our listeners one more time in case anybody is interested in calling. And we have one student here with us in the studio. In Columbia, if you're local, the number is 884-3803. And if you're out of Columbia, anywhere in the U.S., the toll-free number is 866-768-5483. I went back this afternoon and sat and read a couple of different articles that you'd written. One of them was Unrestricted Body Parts and Predictable
right.
Bliss. I don't know if you remember that. And
oh, yeah.
Got a hoot out of it again. And then I was putting together the list of all the things that you've done over your, you know, academic career, and started coming up with all kinds of questions completely disconnected. What was it like to testify for SIPA?
Against. Yes.
Well, against this.
But for the American Library Association.
Well, it's interesting because that relates to to my concerns about LIS professors, because I'm one of the few people who was once a public librarian who could talk about collection development intelligently to the judges. And I spent a lot of time writing a document, which is part of the formal evidence, and then prepping with the lawyer. And what I never understood about these lawyers is they expect you to recite your document, which, you know, I just thought I did the document and then answered questions. So once I got past that particular confusion, I was very well prepared, because they have very good lawyers. And they made the point that I should talk to the judges, because it was annoying to them when witnesses, you know, looked at the lawyers instead of the judges, so I sat at an angle. And I was so well prepared that I finished early, and at one point I looked at the judges and I said, you know, it's really very annoying to have to know all the good things that we do for people in libraries and to be sort of cast as porn palaces for kids when that is not true. It just isn't true on the face of it. And one of the judges leaned over and he said, well, we've had people who have testified to us that that's how kids, especially young teenagers, are using the libraries to look at pornographic pictures, etc. So I took a deep breath and I looked at him and I said, well, you know, I hate to say this because nobody wants to hear it, but that's the culture. And developmentally, they want to look at those pictures. And there was a big laugh in the audience. I'm sure the government lawyers were secretly thrilled that I said it, but the bottom line is, you take any sixth grade predominantly male student, they want to look at pictures of naked women because nobody will show them to them or want to talk to them about it. And the internet, you know, is ripe fodder for that.
Back in my day, it used to be National Geographic.
Well, or it used to be Playboy under the bed. And the problem is that what is on the internet is a lot worse than you know, Zoftic models who have been airbrushed on the pages of Playboy centerfolds. And even in my deposition, the lawyer for the government stuck some group sex nude photo in front of me and said, is that what you want children to look at, et cetera? And I just wanted to wring her neck. Because it's sort of like arguing the case from the exception rather than the rule. And most kids are in there doing homework or playing games or IMing each other, basically, to the kid next door to them. I was reading one of the posts on one of the YALSA lists, and they said, what do you do about instant messaging? Because the kids tie up all the computers, and what they do is instant message the kids sitting right next to them because they love the technology. And instead of restricting them, why the hell aren't librarians using instant messaging to deal with teenagers better? But no. I've been trying to get the technology classes at Queens to deal with instant messaging, and they just sort of groan every time I walk down the hall. But anyway, that's what it was like. The judges for the Third Circuit Appellate Court, one of whom was 80, the lead judge was 80. I hope I'm that smart at 80. Nothing got past them. They were really sharp. And it was sort of fun because, you know, they were all men, and I rarely resort to flirting. At the end of the testimony, that's what I felt like I was doing, because I could tell that they thought I was funny, and I thought I was funny, so what the hell, you know. Ultimately, it didn't do any good when I got to the Supreme Court, because the politics are such they wanted to appease the people who kept yelling and hope that there was a technological fix for this, which so far I don't think there is. But
nothing that's consistently effective.
No, it was an interesting...
Mary Kay, isn't President Bush's latest Supreme Court nominee on the Third Circuit?
He was, but he wasn't one of the three I had, thank God, because okay. I'm quite sure it wouldn't have been as enjoyable an experience.
Just interesting.
I know. I noticed that when he was appointed, yeah. And luckily the luck of the draw did not draw him when I was there. But you have to understand, that particular week was interesting because the lawyers strategically were trying to figure out when to put me on the stand, and they kept pushing the time back, and then they kept worrying about, should I drive to Philadelphia, should I fly to Philadelphia? If I flew and something happened to the plane so I didn't get there in time, what would happen to the case? I mean, they were just beside themselves. So I taught till 9 o'clock at night on Thursday night, or Monday night. I drove over to New Jersey and bummed a bed with friends of mine over there. I drove down to Philadelphia and spent 3 hours being prepped for this, where they told me they were sure they'd get to me immediately. Then I sat in the courtroom for about 3.5 hours watching everything till they did get to me. And and then I drove home, and 2 days later, Philip Pullman arrived from England because we had gotten the Arbuthnot lecture for Queens, and I was in charge of that. And I have rarely had a week that was more exhausting than that particular week. I have to say that Pullman is wonderful if anybody ever hears him speak, but I would prefer not to have those two events juxtaposed in my life again.
Philip Pullman's the author of his Dark Materials, is that? Yeah.
The Golden Compass.
Yeah. The Golden Compass, The Subtle Knife.
Remarkably funny. He's typical Brit in that he has, you know, this very elegant accent. He looks like he combs his hair with an egg beater, but but he was very funny, and 400 people came up and worshipped him. And my main concern by the time that happened was, because I learned a long time ago, if you have an author, take your most beloved friend, preferably if your beloved friend has more money than you do in case they need it, and assign that person to the author so you don't have to worry about him. So, and I always give them the instructions that, short of sleeping with this person, keep them happy, get them places on time, make sure they go wherever they're going. And so I did that with a colleague who had read all his books. She was just ideal for this. But when I got to the place where he was supposed to appear, first there was some other weird thing going on that Queens had scheduled, and nobody had told them they had to get out of there, so we practically threw kids out of the place who had nothing to do with Pullman. They were there for some totally other event, and the adults were oblivious, so we threw them out. Then the Bank Street bookstore that was supposed to sell his books, they were all taking public transportation out from Manhattan, and God knows where they were, and I was stuck selling books. And the one thing I cannot do is count in my head and do math kinds of things where I am figuring out what discounts are and selling multiple books to people with multiple discounted prices. And I mean, I thought I'd go crazy. Luckily, the director of our school at the time, her husband was an engineer who carried his calculator with him all the time, and I sat him down in total indentured servitude to sell books till these stupid people got there. It drove me crazy. But in case anybody wonders how you do all these things, it was one of the more bizarre events. And in the meantime, Pullman's off in the equivalent of Queen's Green Room, meditating on his words and with my friend in tow. And I didn't have to worry about him, but I was so glad when he finally stood up and spoke and it was all over and I could go home and collapse. I couldn't see straight.
Oh, well.
And remember, I've done Stephen King. He was easier than
than Philip Pullman.
Partly because the convention center staff in Virginia Beach was a lot better organized. Getting all of Queens College to march to the same drummer in the same direction is just about impossible. And luckily, the president loved us. If he hadn't, I'd still be trying to arrange that event. So, so I was glad it was done.
Oh, why do you think teenagers are so marginalized as library patrons?
Because they're a pain in the butt to most librarians. They come in groups. They are as big as adults, but they're not quite socialized yet. And in fact, in early adolescence, they take wicked delight in making adults upset, and librarians tend to get upset over all kinds of silly things. The other thing is, I think we've constructed libraries with an assumption of behavior that doesn't have anything to do with real people.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah.
We have something I call the ideal user, or the mythical user, we expect people to, we set up libraries that way, and we expect people to come in and use the library the way we expect them to behave, and they never do. And teenagers are the utter antithesis of the ideal user. They wait till the last minute. They don't like the assignments they have to do. They only half understand them. They don't respect us because they don't respect any adults at that particular age, except maybe their coach and their mother, and maybe not even their mother. And they don't come prepared, and the librarians get all annoyed. And, you know, given the fact that there's a serious problem with the configuration of reference desks, where there's this sort of endless queue of all ages with all kinds of questions that seems to stretch to eternity, you get an awful lot of burned out people, and the last thing they want to see is teenagers. And the saddest story I ever heard was a friend of mine who, she finally switched fields. When she came into the Rutgers doctoral program with me, and she was an extremely accomplished youth services librarian, and she switched and majored in communication, but she became a communication professor. She gave up the library field, and before she came, she had worked in a library in New Jersey, and they hired her to deal with teenagers. And the mistake she made was not doing a diagnosis of the existing staff and trying to figure out what were the boundaries that the director had on this particular wish. Because she went out and the kids adored her. She had a youth advisory board. She did book talks. They flocked to see her in the library. And the rest of the staff went berserk. The last thing they wanted was a library full of teenagers. And the minute she did anything controversial, the director backed off. And finally, she just was made so uncomfortable, she left. And in young adult terms, she was a great success story. But in organizational terms, she was a flop because she had several audiences to deal with, and she didn't know it. It wasn't just get the kids in and be great with the kids, because if you do that, you're just as likely to fall flat on your face because you're going to have people sabotaging you on the staff. And if you have a weak director, which we seem to have a lot of, they're not going to do anything except try to make life uncomfortable so you'll go and they can have a pleasant life again.
A librarian I live with has observed a couple of times that librarians are their own worst enemies, and I think that story just proved that.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is we've created architecturally one big room in which we expect and insist that everybody behave the same way. And whenever I hear somebody, usually somebody young, which upsets me, say, well, we treat everyone the same. We expect the same behavior from everyone. And I look at them and say, that means that automatically you're discriminating against preschoolers and adolescents.
That's true.
There is absolutely no way that you can expect preschoolers, especially young adolescents, to behave that way. And I started, the second or third time I heard that, I started on the lecture circuit saying, we've created spaces where our ideal user is a 65-year-old intellectual, self-sufficient, reverential deaf mute. And on top of that, with all the literature about friendless kids being at risk for suicide and all kinds of social pathology, I said we've basically created an expectation that the only kids we want in those places are sick kids. Normal kids we can't cope with because we don't even recognize them.
I've seen within the last year or so at least one or two presentations or read an article or two on libraries that are making an effort to create a separate space for that
right. That
YA group, that in between, you know, they're not little kids anymore, they're not big people anymore.
Right.
So at least some libraries are acknowledging that there is a different drummer to be dealt with there and are trying to create separate spaces.
Yeah, and I agree with that as long as they understand that space alone is not a service. Because I've seen people become rhapsodic about YA spaces, and that's fine. I'm delighted with, you know, architectural ideas being shared and getting kids involved in the planning process and all the rest, but by the same token, you know, you need staff, you need a plan, you need a program, etc. And where I first became a little suspicious of this was when I was at PLA in Phoenix and I toured the Phoenix Central Library, which of course has Teen Central, which is supposed to be the motherlode of these kinds of spaces. And it really is quite impressive, but it's really quite interesting in several ways. First of all, it's not a collection-centered space. They have some graphic novels in there. They have a whole kitchen with food where they can eat food and soft drinks and everything. They have a huge circular kind of thing with computers. They have music that they can listen to, and the rest. And they have a heavy glass door that separates that from the rest of the library. So everybody went over there to see it, and I went down to the reference staff, and I said, how do you relate to Teen Central? And she said, well, basically, if they want to do homework and they come down here, they have to behave like traditional library users. If they want to take our reference books up to Teen Central, they're welcome to do that. And we just have people who go through, because I think it's a four-story building, we have people who go through the building and return the books to the proper place so people can find them again. But basically, they've, and this is heavily used. I mean, they have 400 and 500 kids in there all the time. I mean, to the point that they probably need to be better staffed just for the sheer supervision of the space. I mean, they're not there simultaneously, they're just in there sequentially. But what interested me was that they've created like an elegant, interesting ghetto. You know, the kids have a lot of things they want, but I keep wondering, what the hell is the program there?
Yeah, how does it, the word, I've been in that building, and the word ghetto occurs to me. It's kind of, I don't know, I saw it not long after it opened, and it struck me as kind of a sterile space, but...
Well, part of that's the peculiar architecture, and mm-hmm. the good thing about it is the kids worked with the architect to design it, which I think should be standard whenever you're designing anything to deal with kids. But it was strange to me, because I kept thinking, if your idea, you know, if you're going to promote reading or you're going to promote information literacy, you're going to do, what are you doing here other than giving them access to play with computers? I love the food. I mean, the idea that kids can't eat in libraries is just crazy, because I think it's one of the main barriers, because the stomach doubles in size in early adolescence, and it's about time somebody recognized it. You know, let them eat. Anybody who does, I was talking to my class last night, anybody who does a program and serves food, once they learn to deal with peanut allergies, which seems to be the thing that's driving everybody in schools crazy, but if you have food for early adolescents and you know who's allergic to peanuts so you don't kill them on the spot, they all absorb the food in about 2 seconds. I mean, you need to plan what you would plan for an equal number of adults and triple or quadruple it, because it's like a foraging herd that comes through and grazes down to the ground. And I've done it, so I know. It's really pretty funny.
Feed them and they will come.
Right.
Yeah.
Pizza.
Right. Well, that's true of almost anybody. I don't like meetings without food.
I think that's pretty much true of college
right.
students too, and LIS faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Feed
right.
them and they will come. Where did Voya begin? Where did the idea come from? How did you get started?
Well, Dorothy and I, let's see, before Voya and before YALSA, YALSA's previous incarnation was the Young Adult Services Division, and they shared Top of the News, their magazine, with the Children's Services Division. Now, the Children's Services Division has transformed itself into the Association of Libraries, Library Service for Children, and YASD has become YALSA. But before then, they were both YASD and CSD, and they shared Top of the News. And they made the, you know, Top of the News, and which became Joys, which is now Young Adult Library Services. They all have volunteer editors, and most of these people burn out after a couple of years, so they get a new volunteer editor. And at the time that we got the idea to do this, they had gotten as volunteer editors two PhD students at Rutgers, whom I subsequently became friends with but didn't like a whole lot at the time. And they basically did not do any article development. They took exactly what came across the transom that was publishable. And there's, inevitably more children's stuff written than YA stuff written. It's partly the personality of the people doing it. It's partly the numbers of the people doing it, because there are more children's people than YA people, unless you count in schools. And even then it changes somewhat, because the secondary people write more. But at that time, it didn't really apply to this. And the two divisions got into a big fight over why there wasn't equal representation, because the children's people were happy and the YA people were really miserable, and to the point that they were sitting at division board meetings at ALA saying they were going to count pages and get their fair share or else. And I remember Dorothy and I were in the hallway at ALA, and we heard one of these editors say, oh, well, those people don't have anything to say.
Whoa.
Good grief.
And I have to tell you, saying that in front of Dorothy Bradrick and me is like waving a red flag right in front of a bull. And so we came home and talked about it, and what did we do? We borrowed $4,000 on a signature loan from a bank in Westchester, and we bought a Gestetner duplicating machine, and we got a kid from the local youth bureau who worked with us as staff, and we gave all our friends a spaghetti dinner for collating the first issue. They had to walk around the table. I don't know, we ran off a 70-page issue or something idiotic, but they had to walk around the table and collate at least 15 issues before we fed them. And then we got a second-class mailing permit and mailed it. And the second one, the printer, let's see, we did two on the duplicator, then we went to offset. Then the printer burned down with the whole issue in it, and the whole issue had to be reconstructed in a weekend. That was one of the more interesting weekends we've spent. Then I got the job at Rutgers in New Jersey, but the printer was still in Westchester, and we ruined the shocks on the car hauling magazines back and forth for a while till we got settled there. And, you know, one thing became another. I think then when we got to Alabama, we discovered graphic artists. Partly because I was in public health school getting my degree, and some graphic artist came to talk in class, and I said, Dorothy, this woman knows stuff we need to know. So we hauled her home to help us and hired a graphic designer, and, you know, one thing led to another. Until finally when, because I had a variety of jobs where I dealt with collection development, and when I went to Montgomery County, you had to sign a big ethics thing that, you know, you didn't have any conflicts of interest, and I certainly could not have a collection development job in a huge library system and also help run a review magazine. So if you look at my job titles through that era, it ebbs and flows depending on what I was doing, because we needed somebody who had a full-time salary during that era. But frankly, as much as I love Voya, you all need to know that if Dorothy were not the Myers-Briggs INTJ she is, there were many times where I thought Voya was like having a crippled child. You couldn't go on vacation. You couldn't do anything. You know, you had a deadline for Voya. You had to make love to the mailman because the damn books kept coming. I mean, I can't tell you how wild it was to live at home and do this magazine. But on balance, I have to say, you know, now that I'm older and I can look back on it, it was a lovely thing to do. But at the time, there were moments where I wished it would have all gone away. And the funny thing after this was we had a group of friends in Alabama who were, I don't know, some sort of feminist collective. And they got on my nerves as often as they intrigued me. But they decided they wanted to start a magazine, and they'd make collective decision making. And when they sat in our living room and told us that, we both laughed until we cried. Because we couldn't figure out how they were going to have a magazine with nobody in charge. And on top of which, one of the ones who wanted to do it had been out of work and wanted to help us at one point. And she had some undetected learning disability where she put stamps in the lower left-hand corner of every envelope or mailing we asked her to do. So trying to figure out how she was going to be part of a collective that ran a magazine is one of the more hilarious discussions I've had in my life. But basically, I have to say that Kathy McRae was Dorothy's hand-picked successor, we've basically been very happy with what she does with the magazine. She works like a dog. Nobody has an easy life at that company in terms of workload, but she is very smart, and she's certainly done an awful lot to make it look better and to start new features, and you know, I couldn't be happier with it.
It's a fantastic publication.
Yeah. I wish it could do more with AV other than just columns, but we went through trying to review videos and trying to review music, and every time you get away from print, life gets much more difficult. The distributors don't understand libraries. They don't send you the right information. They try to recycle old stuff. I mean, it just went on. And finally, we just gave up and decided to do what we could do best. And I think one of the things we did best was the integration of adult and juvenile books for this age group, because I'm still annoyed that the Prince Award does not include adult books that teenagers like. And everybody who deals with this age group knows that there are a fair number of adult books, especially for the science fiction readers, that you should pay attention to. And mixing them up like that confused the publishers totally, but we made a point that way. And we made a point about science fiction and science fiction readers, because the most literate reviewers, the most literate YA readers still tend to be science fiction people. And we also, even though that made for some interesting conversations on the phone, got some of the evangelical and Christian presses to send stuff. It was the first time any of that had been reviewed, long before Library Journal got religion. And
inspirational reading. Yes. I called it inspirational reading.
So, and we had, we had small press stuff. The Allison Press, the small gay press in Boston, was always sending us review books, because we really are First Amendment purists, and we wanted to do the full range of what it was kids would like. Often, regardless of whether librarians would like them, we tried to write reviews where we told librarians what would alarm them about something, but we weren't going to avoid the content if we thought kids would really like it. This led to some interesting things, too, because when we reviewed Binge, which I reviewed because it's a mesmerizing 90-page read, the author didn't understand that the review was not going to guarantee him keeping that book in print forever. And when sales fell below a certain level, he used to call us up and ask us what to do, until he became a total pest. And as much as I love the book, I was happy when I finally persuaded him to go away and bother other people, because I didn't know what to do with him. There are many, many funny untold tales that I'm sure I will think of if you keep me on the phone. But yeah, in any case, I really like the book. I have to say that if he's somewhere listening to me.
Let me give the phone number one more time, and then one of the students in Teen Lit asked this semester, I'll pass that along, that has to do with Boya. In Columbia, it's 884-3803. And 866-768-5483, toll free. How did you develop the rating system for Voya that's used for the reviews?
Dorothy developed that, and I think she got it. There was a little now defunct review thing, like almost like a newsletter that came out. They were reviewing music, and they had a similar rating system, and she looked at it and thought, that's the way we can try to show the juxtaposition of quality and popularity. And it got to be funny, because Paula Danziger said she wanted to be a 5Q, 5P when she grew up. Because she never got a 5Q. She'd always get 5Ps, but she never got a 5Q, and she was really waiting. She developed that, and I cannot remember what rocking chair or something. I tend to remember as the name of it, but God, it's been over 20 years, so I don't remember now.
That's a fantastic system.
Yeah, it is, because a lot of people in young adult or who serve young adults tend to come out of children's work, and you know, in children's you can have a limited collection of high quality, because although even that's not true anymore with the media, because kids are very susceptible to popular media and spin-offs and things. But for a long time, they weren't reading the New York Times bestseller list, and they weren't doing all that, so they were sort of captives. And you could do quality stuff more. With adolescents, you move straight into a pop culture mindset, and plus, you know, they were distracted by many other things, and you gave them what they wanted to keep them reading and to try to match what they were interested in. And I think a lot of people who come out of children's are still looking more at quality than at what kids like, and what kids or adults or anybody likes isn't necessarily quality. And I can say that quite freely because even though I was an English major, I still to this day do not like contemporary literary fiction as well as I like genre fiction. And I shock my classes when I say that, but I said I don't like it because it's character-driven, introspective, occasionally depressing. And I said, I like something that moves. I like a plot-driven story with a lot of action. And for the kinds of satisfactions I used to get in literary fiction, I prefer nonfiction now.
How do you move youth services people from that quality, literary-driven kind of thing to focusing more on what the kids want to read rather than what you want them to read?
Well, the first thing you point out is they're hypocrites, because if they only want the kids to read what they want them to read, that makes them no different than censors as far as I'm concerned. So it's hypocrisy to say, well, we don't want anybody to censor our books, but we're going to do the same thing censors do, but we're doing good stuff and they're doing bad stuff, so therefore we're different. Forget it. I think you're exactly the same. Secondly, all the new research on boys make it quite clear that if we want boys to read, we've got to get off our narrative fiction mindset. You know, it's a monomania. If it's not narrative fiction, it's no good. And boys don't like that stuff. Many of them, some do. They like science fiction. They like nonfiction. The assistant YA coordinator in Queensboro Public, who has two males in their YA office, the coordinator and his assistant are both men. And Bill Stack came to my reading motivation class, and he said, you know, I have to read all this fiction stuff because of my job, but he said, what I really love is the almanac. And he went into rhapsodies over the World Almanac. And all the women in the class are just looking at him like he had arrived from Mars, and I was just grinning because I even make a point in the reference class when we get to the Guinness Book of World Records, and I said, remember, this is a reference book, but it's also one of the most popular books with kids ever written, and you should not just have it in the reference collection. You should have 10 copies of it where kids can take it out. You know, we don't understand that. The same thing with magazines. The reason I adore Patrick Jones for many, many reasons is that long before any of us got it, he was saying, why aren't you buying popular magazines for kids in multiple copies, just like you should be doing with paperbacks? And don't worry about whether they're indexed or they do have anything to do with school assignments, because kids love magazines. I think we have to pay more attention to different format preferences, and I also think we need to get off applying literary standards to what should be reader response standards.
Absolutely.
And we don't quite understand either one, and I realize this because the local Nassau library system had a mock prints meeting. Maybe they have them every year, but 2 years ago I was invited to go, and I read all the prints, the books they thought would be selected, because the prints committee is closed. You don't know anything till they make their great decision. And I was sitting there listening to everybody, and they had assigned librarians to stand up and defend certain books. And you know, the criterion of the prints committee is that the book must be two. There are two criteria. The book must be written for young adults, and it must be of high literary quality, undefined. So I watched all these librarians go around the room, and these are all MLS librarians, some with years of experience, and they'd stand up and they'd say, well, the author says X, Y, and Z, and it made me feel this way and that way, and therefore I think it has high literary quality and should get the award. So I'm listening to this, and I poked the woman sitting next to me, and I said, I'm sorry, but everything everybody said has been reader response. I wanted to say not very intelligent reader response, but reader response. It's how the book made them as readers react. And I said the problem with literary quality is that it has to do with aesthetic construction, and the better the aesthetic construction of anything, the more distancing it is from readers. It diminishes the number of people who can access it because it's like reading a very good poem or something. And I said I was very frustrated because the book that won that year, it was the one about the teenage father, which I thought was a neat book and certainly was the most popular of the books, but I don't think it was the best in literary quality terms if you really analyze those books by the way they were constructed and actually written regardless of audience. But the bottom line is you can't deal with teenagers regardless of audience. You just can't. And it's one of my frustrations with the Prince Award, because especially since it's a closed committee, I think the whole damn committee should be opened up so we can listen to what they say.
I think we have a caller.
Okay.
Sally Snyder from Nebraska.
Okay.
Hello, this is Sally.
Hi.
Hi, Sally.
I have been listening and really enjoying this session of the LIS radio, particularly your presentation. And I had a question about formats, and I heard you talk a little bit about that, but
sure.
You had said earlier that why aren't librarians using the instant messaging that kids are so fond of?
Right.
And I also was thinking of how things, as we all recognize, have been changing to electronic books and
sure.
and iPods and things. And how do you think librarians are going to be able to make this changeover?
Well, at least for adults, there are any number of big library systems that are already doing downloadable audiobooks for their users. In terms of kids, at least locally, I don't find that young adult librarians are buying many audiobooks or understanding in public library terms how to use them. I think they're a little better in school libraries, or at least they understand their potential uses better there. And I'm frustrated by and the other problem is technological, because there's some problem with Apple and the iPod that makes it difficult to just download it and play it directly. You've got to have another kind of MP3 player. You've got to go through some intermediate step to actually play one of them on an iPod. But I think we're missing the boat in several ways, because we should first of all be asking the kids what kinds of things they're interested in and showing them what may be possible. I think we should be applying major pressure to Apple, because Steve, as long as Steve Jobs is just, you know, doing whatever he's doing there, the industry alone cannot make that switch. And I think we've got to get some of the purchasers of Apple applying the pressure. But the other problem with Apple is when they almost went bankrupt, they got out of the educational market. So I'm not sure that we have the leverage that we once had. But I still think reference for kids in a personal sense should be done over IM. I've seen doctors that have done that with health information, and I see no reason why librarians couldn't try to do it. My only caveat there is I teach basic reference at Queen's, and they have to go out and compare. They have to go out as surrogate users and ask a question face-to-face, telephone, chat, and email reference formats and compare the experience and what happened to them. And at least my experience locally is that most of the libraries who got into chat reference should shoot themselves rather than continue it, because they simply don't know how to do it well. And email reference, if you get an answer 4 days later, you know, it's a big deal. They warn you, you can't get an instant answer. And the problem with the kids is we cannot keep doing this. It's bad enough that we do it with adults, but we cannot do this if we're going to do it for kids. you know, they live in an eternal present. And so we've got to understand what their culture and their expectations are, and we can't do this half-assed technology thing because everybody thinks we should be chatting away and doing reference work 24/7. A lot of the reference librarians I know basically are just Googling for people, and I find that sort of appalling, too. So, yes, I think we could be doing a lot more technologically with kids instead of banning them from doing it in libraries, you know, staying off chat. But I would like to see it done well. And the only person I would recommend to read about that is, Jacobson, what's her married name? There's a new book out, it's from ALA, called I Found It on the Internet. And it's by the woman who used to be the lab librarian at the University of Illinois, and she really knows how kids use technology. It's an extremely good book about learning how to do it. Learning what's going on. It's not going to technically teach you to do IMing if you've never done it, but I certainly think we should be using those things. The same way when we're doing programs for kids, we should be giving bookmarks that have websites on them. I think it's very silly not to do bookmarks that don't include authors' websites, you know, topical websites, etc. It's just silly not to integrate that stuff.
Almost like pathfinders.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Why did you decide to get a PhD in communications rather than library science?
Well, it's interesting. I was going to do the major in library studies. At Rutgers at the time, you could do information science, communication, or library studies. And I knew I didn't want to do information science. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wasn't it. I could say that's still true some days. But I was going to major in library studies and minor in communication, and I really got interested in communication, and the faculty teaching library studies were pretty weak. And I decided I would rather be a little more intellectually challenged. Now, the interesting thing about this is that everybody advised me not to do it. They were worried that there were biases on the communication faculty and that I might fail exams and all of this. And, you know, this is, again, was like waving a red flag because I'm pig-headed. And I also adored my advisor from the first class I took there. He co-taught the basic class for everybody who went there. And then I had him for qualitative research methods because you had to take both qualitative, you had to pass both a qualitative and quantitative methods comp. And then exams, and then you did comps. And everybody who took that qualitative methods course with him found it a life-changing experience. He is that good. And he's a social psychologist, Chicago trained, and he's interested in how communicative activity relates to identity. And of course, if you're interested in adolescents and you're not interested in identity, I don't know how you work with them. So I went to see him and said, you know, if you think you can get me out of here before I'm ready for a nursing home, would you be interested in working with me? And he was great. And he had also done research himself with videotapes. So the fact that I already had and then subsequently got videotapes of interactions between adults and kids, he was very interested in that. So we had a grand time. And he also was interested in Irving Goffman's theories, which I liked because they explain a great deal of what we do. So we just had a good time, and I really loved it. So, but I wanted to do it because I'd reached the point, I never wanted to be a library director. Line management I find very boring, and because it's so boring, I think the people who do it should make money because it's so boring. Let them make the money and do it. I wish more of them did it well. But in terms of personality, I'm much better either as a trainer or an educator or an organizer or something. I just don't do line management well. So I decided I also wanted to write and actually do research. And being totally ignorant of the time constraints on an academic's life, I just thought this was the way I could do it. So, you know, there were a whole lot of reasons there. And I really found a home. I wish for all these schools that merge with communication, they, instead of looking at communications technology, they understood how rich communication theory is in terms of our field and in terms of influencing our field. But most of them never get beyond Brenda Durbin, or they think it only has to do with information technology. And, you know, they never get past some version of sender, message, receiver, and interpersonal communication is just filled with theories and approaches that are useful to us. I get really annoyed because I think librarianship is an arena in which you have both applied social science as well as applied information science, and I think the social science gets lost when we're just subsumed into the information science.
I agree.
Crap.
And I have thought for a long time with school librarianship, this whole revolving discussion that's been going on since 1900 about collaboration, what that all boils down to is that you have interaction between one individual and another individual, and you cannot impose that from the top.
Right.
That has to be built with personal relationships from the bottom.
Sure.
So, but we keep, you know, here we go again. You know, we have another ALA committee that's going to advocate for school librarians, and it's going to be the same old thing. It's going to be a repeat, nothing new.
Well, and you also run the risk because of the committee of being made strange all over again. You know, why do they need somebody advocating for them? And everybody else will get suspicious.
That's true.
It was interesting doing the dissertation because I looked at adult adolescent service encounters in the library context, and I had, first I looked at all the pronouncements from ALA about what good service was, and then I had two taped interviews that librarians did for me, one with senior high school kids in school, one with a youth advisory board junior high kids in a public library. Then I did an interview of a public library, regional public library staff, excluding the youth services staff, because I wanted to get at the attitudes with the rest of them. And so I did statements on service, perceptions of service, and then the third part was I basically wired a high school librarian. So I got audio tapes of all her interactions, and I got videotapes of all the circ desk interactions in a high school on a staff-designated normal day. And it was really quite fascinating because, among other things, since I come from a public library background, I had never had to confront the PASS system before.
Yes.
And I remember having dinner with somebody. I was sitting with a whole bunch of school librarians I knew, and I said, tell me about the PASS system. And they all looked at me like I was crazy, and I said, do you really spend all your time asking for passes, you know, giving out passes, et cetera? And they said, yes, of course. And I said, is this just taken for granted? And I was truly appalled at the amount of time this took. Appalled that somebody would get a master's degree to do nothing but be a traffic cop.
Yep.
It's the biggest waste of human intellect I can possibly imagine, and it is so ubiquitous it's taken for granted. They all thought I was crazy.
It's the regimentation of school culture.
Yeah.
And you sign passes, you sign them in, you sign them out.
Right.
Yeah.
And you wonder why school teachers burn out after a while.
Well, and between that and the testing and the idiocy of No Child Left Behind, I also have moments of feeling with all the regimentation and the guards at the doors and everything, especially the post-Columbine mindset of school administrators, that, you know, most kids can graduate from school, if they do, and go to the county jail and not know they've changed places.
There is too much truth in that statement.
I know.
And I agree. No Child Left Behind, I think, is we're just leaving more and more kids behind.
Yeah.
We're going back to a can of peas, we put it on the assembly line, and if it has a dent or a, you know, the label isn't on quite straight, we kind of push it off the line. And
well, the other thing is, teaching for the test has made crazy people crazier. I mean, you know, you hear about school libraries where they've leveled every book and they won't let a kid read a book that's not on their reading level. And, you know, they have to read 25 books that hopefully they enjoy and understand, but of course they can't upset absolutely anybody. It just goes on and is crazy making to me. And I have a very hard time as an educator because I don't want to discourage someone who's going to be good. And one of our very best graduates is one of the best school librarians I've ever seen in my life, but she would have been good at anything. But I would have a very hard time in that kind of environment. I simply don't have the personality for it because I don't know if you can say this on radio, but one of the reasons I never wanted to be a line administrator is, you know, there's this phrase that starts when the right ass is presented, and I'm just as likely to bite it. And I have a very hard time because I don't want to share that with the school librarians who are, at least now with the new regulations in New York, the ones coming into our program who want to be school librarians are far less naive because they've been classroom teachers. We used to have some real holly-go-lightlys about 7 years ago, and I'm glad that's changed.
It's so different in each state. I know we're experiencing a critical need in Missouri, and
right.
We've got some initial certification people who already have masters in library science and are coming out of public library youth services and into school libraries, and it's a very different world.
Oh, yeah, it's a big culture shock. And then we have one, you know, I did have a Midwesterner, a really good student, and she was very funny and good, and she goes off to South Dakota and gets a high school library job and emails me and says, why don't you teach book repair?
Oh, Lord.
And I said, I hate to tell you, but do you really want book repair and something that's giving you a master's degree? And I gave her four URLs on the web that taught
for
her step-by-step book repair. And I thought, you know, I made my point. She hasn't emailed me since, and I wasn't trying to humiliate her, but I was trying to make a point here. You know, do you really want book repair? So
and
anyway,
you
I
would,
mean, most
you would
my students, I should say for anybody listening besides you two who may be more used to me, I tend to be funny in class because I get bored easily. That's why I've changed jobs a lot, you know, and that's probably why I got a PhD and everything else. But I don't go out of my way to humiliate students. I had somebody in my office tonight who's dropping out of my class, and I said, that's fine, you need to do what you need to do. And he said, I thought I wanted to be a librarian, but I don't like any of the courses. And I said, I can understand that completely. I didn't like any of mine either. And I said, there's sort of a necessary tedium to the process that doesn't convey the joy of doing this. And I said, the first 5 years I was a librarian, I was bewildered by the fact that people paid me money to have such a good time. And I said, the problem is, by the 10th year of doing it, I was hearing the same arguments coming around again and again, and I began to realize this was indeed work. This wasn't just play. And then got probably more realistic and maybe some necessary cynicism about the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I said, if you're not having people convey that to you, you need to find some experiences to get it. And I told them a variety of ways he might do it. I don't go out of my way to be mean to students, even though I am pretty snarky in terms of my mouth.
We didn't know that.
No.
I heard Margaret Monroe years and years ago say something to the effect that if it doesn't bring you joy, don't do it.
Oh, I know.
I got to admit, I had a blast in both my library schools, my master's at Kentucky and my doctorate at Wisconsin. And I was flabbergasted when I got out into the working library world and discovered that people had hated library school. And I thought, what the heck was the matter with you people? I had a great time when I got my degrees. But
well, I had a good time because it was the first time I'd been away from home. I had commuted to college, and so I was away from home, and I would go into New York and do three museums in a day, which would literally put me in the grave now. But I met all these friends, and I just had a grand time. And I thought it was some great fun. And on top of that, since I had gone to a small Catholic college, because remember, my name is Mary Catherine Elizabeth, I sort of drip saint. I went to Rutgers, and there was the library with all this neat stuff that they would never have in a Catholic college library. So I read everything from the Daily Worker to God knows what all. I'm sure I was corrupted on the spot, but I just had a grand time.
We're heading toward 8:30, and about time to wrap it up. I really appreciate your time and discussing and chatting and talking with us this evening. Are there any parting words of wisdom that you'd like to leave with listeners this evening?
Well, for people who are feeling worn out from some of the, bureaucratic feuds, remember that the kids need you and try to keep your eye on that because they really do. If any of you want to get a PhD, talk to me because I can give you a realistic view toward getting one. A lot of youth people say, oh, well, I want to teach children's literature. I don't want to study information science. And they're really quite ignorant of how LIS faculty are put together. And I think if they went into it with their eyes open, they could do a great deal because it really does make a difference if you're a full-time faculty member. You can certainly teach children's literature as an adjunct if you're good, but you will never influence curriculum, admissions, all the other things and some of the policies that make the schools run well. And the other thing is, don't be a sheep. If something annoys you, tell somebody about it. Write to a publisher if you want something changed. Raise some hell with Apple if you think they should do something better with their iPods to help libraries. Don't just sit and expect the rest of the world to do it, because I've discovered that people are very responsive, and they normally will think, if this person is annoyed, maybe there are other people. And usually I try to offer constructive criticism. Can I help you do this? Or have you thought you might do this, et cetera, et cetera, and not just be curmudgeonly about it. And it normally works. And don't be shy, for God's sake. If you're at conference and you want to meet somebody, walk up and say, hi, I'm so-and-so. I wanted to meet you forever. Remember that those of us who are the so-called famous ones do put our pants legs on one at a time, the same as the rest of you. And I hope I see you this year. I'm going to PLA, not ALA conference, but I hope I see some of you there. And
might do that.
We've
been talking about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking to you probably in March.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Super.
Good night.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's a wrap for this First Tuesday webcast. Once again, thanks to Dr. Mary Kay Chelton, Dr. Seavey, and Dr. Adkins, who's still here, for being guests. And our best wishes for success to those of you who are immersed in comps this week at MU. Last but certainly not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us this evening. We welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions regarding LIS Radio. Just send them to ESSER, ESSERL, at missouri.edu and include LIS Radio in the subject line. This program will be archived on the LIS Radio website at lisradio.missouri.edu. Allow 2 to 3 days for the program to become available. Thanks to Jennifer Crispin, and I don't know if Matthew's still here, and he says he's gone, for twisting the knobs and keeping the wires untangled on the control panel this evening. The intro and exit music is from Sarah Brightman's Dive CD, and tonight we leave you with Second Element 2. Join us again on LIS Radio at this same URL. Good evening.
Wasn't it you who was filling the streets? Wasn't it you who was breaking the line?
This has been LIS Radio, a production of the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri, Columbia.